Very, very tough challenge. It doesn't make any sense to me. I was among the people who probably, up until maybe 3 or 4 days before the war started, was convinced that Trump wouldn't attack Iran. And the reason why I believe that is because it seemed like such a stratospherically dumb idea
Right.
that I was literally saying, come on, man, nobody is that stupid. But there we are, for some reason, Trump pulled the trigger, which I think will go down in history as one of the greatest strategic blunders of all time, because the consequences haven't even started to accrue. This is going to have very severe long-term consequences on not just Iran and United States and Israel, but on the world in general. So I think this is going to be with us for a while. I don't dare predict how bad it's gonna be, but already where it is, oil is nearly double what it was less than 3 months ago. In December of 2025, we were at $60 a barrel. We are inching close to 120 at the moment.
Alex Craner, my friend, and somebody I'm really looking forward to chatting with. Good afternoon to you. How are you?
Very good, Andy. Good to be with you. Thank you for the invite and greetings to everyone out there.
It's always good to spend time with you. So it's the world has gone well, it's gone mad for a while unless you try to connect the dots. Let's start with where we're at here and now. I think we were both surprised that the last, I want to say, going on 3.5 weeks happened with the conflict in Iran. I'll call it a war in Iran. And that surprised me that that was going to happen. Talk to me about that and the surprise, and just try to make sense of this with me.
Very, very tough challenge. It doesn't make any sense to me. I was among the people who probably, up until maybe 3 or 4 days before the war started, was convinced that Trump wouldn't attack Iran. And the reason why I believe that is because it seemed like such a stratospherically dumb idea.
Right.
That I was literally saying, come on, man, nobody is that stupid. But there we are, for some reason, Trump pulled the trigger, which I think will go down in history as one of the greatest strategic blunders of all time, because the consequences haven't even started to accrue. This is going to have very severe long-term consequences on not just Iran and United States and Israel, but on the world in general. And I think that in the longer term, it's going to be a positive. But in the short term, we have to be prepared for a lot more pain than anybody ever expected, because not only are we looking at an acute energy crisis, we're also looking at possibly famine in large parts of the world. It seems to me that Trump pulled the trigger on the gamble that he would get his way and that the war would last 2 or 3 days, that it would bludgeon the Iranians into submission, that they would come to the negotiating table and accept the terms, and that he would be able to declare a glorious victory, and maybe seal the deal for the midterm elections. There's some intel out there now saying that the reason why Trump and the Israelis felt confident is because the the head of the IRGC, Iranian Revolutionary Guards Forces, General Ghani, that he was in the dock, that they bought and paid him, and that he would be, let's say, opening the gates of Troy for them. But the Iranians were on to him, and they removed him. I don't know if he got executed. I think he did. But basically, they sensed the betrayal and removed him from power. But even if that was true, or, you know, Trump was convinced that this was the truth, that was still a really, really dumb gamble, because you have to kind of, you know, this is not a real estate deal where if it doesn't go your way, oh, well, you know, you're going to lose some money, you're going to bankrupt the company, and on you go, carry on as before. This is going to have a very, very severe long-term consequences. You know, starting wars is very easy. Ending wars is extremely difficult. And the second they start, everything unfolds differently from what you might have expected or predicted.
Mm-hmm.
And so to make such a gamble for no good reason is just literally stratospherically stupid. And we know that, you know, the Western powers have had Iran in their crosshairs for more than 20 years. You remember Wesley Clark in 2007 saying that they were planning to take down 7 countries in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the last in that 7 countries was Iran. And Wesley Clark was recounting what happened in 2001, in September or October 2001. And so 5 years from 2001 puts us within 2006. So they were planning to take down the Iranian regime within 2006, 20 years ago, Andy.
Right.
Except nobody dared to do it. And you know why? Because they knew they couldn't, that the odds of success were very, very unfavorable. They understood that Iran was a power to reckon with, that they have escalatory dominance in the region. They have all kinds of levers of pressure, like Hormuz, like mm-hmm. destroying the Gulf kingdoms and their energy infrastructure, and to cause a massive disruption to the whole world economy, to the US economy, that there would be probably high casualty count and all that. So nobody dared. And even Trump knew not to do this, because there was great pressure exerted on him in 2019 during his first term to attack Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Iranians downed one of the American drones in the Persian Gulf. And then there was this massive lobbying campaign on Trump to be tough, to show the Iranians, to punish them, and to launch a war against them. And he knew not to do that. Well, you know, 6 years later, here we are. No, yeah, 6-7 years later, here we are. And he went ahead and did it. There's no way to win, but Trump also doesn't have a face-saving way out.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's not even clear whether he's in charge at all, because a lot of people close to the administration are saying that the Israelis are in the driver's seat and that they're driving the train. And one thing that is a given with the Israelis is that they will escalate at every turn. And then we had an example exactly yesterday. So today's Friday, 20th March. Yesterday, the Israelis bombed the Pars gas field that is between Iran and Qatar. And the Iranians said, you do that, we're going to bomb yours. You know, we're doing it. And, you know, they haven't bluffed yet. So they retaliated. And then they said, like, okay, you do this again, we're going to wipe all of the oil production, oil and gas producing facilities in the whole region. So, you know, be our guests. Trump doesn't want this. It's obvious that he doesn't want it. He said he asked the Israelis not to do it. They did it anyway. Well, what's Trump going to do about it? What is he going to do about it? You know, is he going to go bomb Tel Aviv? Of course not. And Israelis have every reason to escalate because they are in an existential agony, basically. They have nothing left to lose. And as far as they're concerned, the worse the better, because the worse they dig themselves into trouble, the more powers like the United States, but also, you know, Britain and other European powers will not be able to stand on the sidelines, and they're going to feel coerced maybe to join the fight on the side of Israel. So, you know, they have a long shot chance of uniting the West against Iran. So they will keep escalating and keep making the situation worse. From Iranian point of view, they have no incentive to go back to the status quo and to end this fight quickly. Mm-hmm. They are prepared for a long war of attrition. And I think that their strategic objectives is to completely remove all threats to their national security, which means basically evicting the United States and other Western powers from the Middle East and possibly ending the existence of Israel as it's constituted today. So I think this is going to be with us for a while. I don't dare predict how bad it's gonna be, but already where it is, oil is nearly double what it was less than 3 months ago. You know, in December of 2025, we were at $60 a barrel. We are inching close to 120 at the moment. And then if you look at the long-term chart of oil prices, this is nothing. We were at $120 a barrel in 2022. Mm-hmm. And we were at $140 a barrel in 2008. So this is not particularly exceptionally high price. But what happened in Iran is the single biggest disruption to the oil market in the whole history of oil markets.
Yeah.
So we ain't seen nothing yet, you know. This is still, you know, like the avalanche that's like coming your way, but it's still there. So you're just thinking, I'm fine. Everything's okay still. Well, at some point, it swamps you. It's at some point, it, you know. So I'm afraid that we are in that situation, you know, like we can tell the avalanche is coming our way. But, you know, or the Titanic struck the iceberg, but the band still plays. So, you know, grab another drink.
Yeah, right. Divorcing ethics here, and just for the record, I'm pretty much against all war. It was just mind-blowing to me, the strategy behind this. And I was talking to a friend maybe a week or so ago discussing this. And I'm trying to get back to the why, and I don't think you can answer that or I can answer that. It's one of three things. It's one, which I don't believe is true, that Iran was an existential threat to the U.S. in the form of a nuke, which I don't think is true. But put that on the spectrum of possibilities, and that they were going to use it. Or number, so he would. They were right, which again, just for the record, I'm not in that camp, but I'm going to keep that in the spectrum. Number two, he just got really, really bad information, really bad intel, and this was just a huge strategic mistake. And the third one, that there was some kind of leverage, and your mind would wander what that leverage is. And I don't know to do this, whether that was Lindsey Graham beating the war drum or if it was Epstein, or I have no idea. Because I'm just, that's just so confusing to me. That's number one. And then it's everything that you just said. I mean, I think oil prices might come down a little bit from here, but I think the longer term trend is just, which is already, I think, oil going up is just exasperated. Not only including fertilizer for food, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's just beyond me. And so now I'm in the point is like gaming this out. And I don't, it's impossible to say how this game's out almost. There's so many wild cards.
Yeah, I agree with it. Well, okay. So first, regarding the regarding Iranian nuke, I don't buy that. And you know, it doesn't matter what you think or what I think. We have a unanimous assessment of all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies with high confidence that Iran stopped work on a nuclear weapon in 2003, and that they never restarted that work. And this unanimous assessment has been reiterated several times, the last time a year ago in March of 2025 by Tulsi Gabbard. Nothing changed. Okay, nothing changed. So it doesn't matter whether somebody thinks that Iranians are evil people. You know, Trump said that Grand Ayatollah Ali Khamenei was one of the most evil people in history. It doesn't matter. It's, you know, the official record says they are not a threat. They're not working on a nuclear weapon. They don't have a nuclear weapon. And they sure as hell don't have means to deliver the nuclear weapon over 10,000 miles to strike at the United States. So there's just no conceivable way you could say that they were a threat. They were not. Then, you know, we have to take into account an empirical fact that the United States has instigated more than 80% of all wars fought in the world between 1946 and today. That's an empirical fact. And where does it come from? Because what you said, you're totally against the war. Of course, you're totally against the war. Everybody is against the war because ordinary people have nothing to gain in war. You know, like if you or your children are sent to war, the best you can get out of it is to come home intact. That's the best you can get out of it. Meanwhile, you're going to have to leave your business behind. You're going to have to leave your family behind. So you lose. Whatever happens, you lose. We have to look at who has the incentive for war, because that's going to be who is pushing all the levers that they have in order to make sure that the war happens.
Israel and the defense contractors. That's what I would say.
No, it goes still a notch or
Bankers.
two higher. Basically, they've had Iran in their crosshairs for a while. Why? Because Iran doesn't want to give their natural resource wealth to Western corporations. The incentive, the real core incentive to change the Iranian government so that they would change their mind about this is only the banking cartel has that incentive. Why? Because the moment they have political control over a region or a nation, then their clients can get contracts to develop these natural resources, which means that their clients, and we're talking about, you know, Halliburton's and BP's and ExxonMobil's and Chevron's of the world are going to be financing this development with these banks. They're going to go to Wall Street for loans to finance all these developments. So the second, say, JP Morgan issues a loan to Chevron, that moment, that loan has become an asset on JP Morgan's balance sheet. And that asset is now a performing asset because Chevron has to pay it back with interest. And it is secured by the, what's the word now? Collateral. That's Iranian resource, Iranian oil or gas or whatever it is. You know, it can be arable land, it can be timber, it can be Iranian ports and airports, infrastructure,
The Straits of Hormuz.
exactly. It can be anything, but anything that produces economic value, just by that flick of a pen of extending a loan to your client to go to Iran to do whatever they have to do to repay that loan to you, that country's, that region's natural resource wealth translates directly into the wealth for the banker. And I think that that's the core incentive that's driving all these permanent wars. And you know, there was great hope that Trump would change the trajectory of this. And for a while, it looked like he would. But in the end, it seems that the pressure of this is so overwhelming and so irresistible that he wasn't able to resist it. I don't buy the stories about Epstein because there isn't much there. You know, we've seen a lot of photographs coming out
I'd agree.
of Trump with young girls. I suspect. No, I'm certain that a lot of those photographs are fake, maybe AI generated or something, because I know, you know, like I've seen some of these photographs and they were different photographs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've seen Trump in that photograph, except that young girl that is next to him or on his lap, she wasn't part of that scene in the original picture. So, you know, like a lot of, and then you know, they've been the Democrats have been trying to put Trump in prison and you know to take him out of the political life
Exactly, it would already
for 8 years.
happened.
And if there was something there, they would have used it
He
against
would have
him.
used it.
Obviously, so you know he did have contacts with Jeffrey Epstein, but I don't think there's anything. And you know, Trump obviously has a taste for grown-up women. So I don't, let's say anything is possible, but I think that, and then Julian Assange said, who apparently had access to these files, that there's nothing incriminating against Trump in those files. So based on that, and based on the fact that they didn't pull anything out during the times where they were trying to impeach him over anything they could, they didn't get anything out, tells me that it's probably not the reason. Now, you didn't mention one possibility, which is the most bizarre aspect of it, and that is the Jewish eschatology.
Yeah,
This is
100%. 100%.
an extremely fascinating field. I first heard about this about a year ago from a Muslim friend of mine who, you know, who spent time studying Jewish and Muslim and Christian eschatologies. And so basically, you know, the one part of the Jewish community, there's like a what they want is the coming of the Messiah, which was promised to them during their Babylonian exile. And so they're waiting for the arrival of the Messiah. And so now part of the Jewry believes that none of this can happen by the action of men, that it all has to be
Ushered with the help of us, yeah.
created by God. And even Jewish sovereignty and the Third Temple and the creation of the State of Israel, that it all has to come from God. And that if Jews take those matters into their own hands and start creating the State of Israel and the Temple and all this by themselves, then they break the covenant with God, and then God will exile them.
Forsaken.
The promised land would exile them, we would evict them. Anyway, but then there's other factions in the Jewish community who think like, this is all taking too long. We should take things into our own hand, and we should help God prepare the ground. So they went ahead, created this Zionist movement, and they created the State of Israel. And now, you know, the preparing for the coming of the Messiah apparently involves the Armageddon, because you know they need to create the messianic times in order for the Messiah to come, or more precisely for the Messiah to reveal himself, because Messiah is supposedly already here, but he will not reveal himself until Armageddon, right? There has to be. And why does that have to happen? Because the Jews believe that they have to be redeemed for their sins. And in order for them, I mean, this, you might think this is completely insane, but I looked into it and it's very real. And the,
I don't think it's completely insane. I grew up not believing this, but I had a lot of my community was evangelical. And that is part of evangelical Christianity, not all of it, and it's only a fraction, if you would. But I just remember hearing all the time about two God's chosen people, Christians and the Jews, or the State of Israel, really. There's two. And when you
Christians
forsake,
and Jews, but especially the Jews.
especially the Jews, and I mean, you even, and then if we forsake our, if we forsake Israel, we're forsaking God. And again, it goes deeper than that, but that's the gist of Zionism. And you would even have people like Ted Cruz, who's, you know, a voter in policy, geopolitical policy, just recently said, "Hey, I support Israel because of things that, you know, passages in the Old Testament of whoever forsakes the Jews, you will also be forsaken." So you have all that too, which is just for the record, is really, really bad Christian theology. I mean, eschatology, really bad.
Absolutely.
But it has had such a bad impact. It is destroyed, killed, destroyed countries and killed millions of people now.
That
And
theology is to Christianity as Wahhabism and Salafism is to Islam. And as you know, this
Yes.
Zionist project is to Jewish religion. But anyway, do you know what redemption of Jews entails?
Tell me.
It entails punishment. And so in order for Jews to be punished,
Then their
they
sins are
need to
atoned.
draw the wrath of the world upon themselves. So, you know, this movement called Chabad Lubavitch, which has basically been the support of Benjamin Netanyahu, say that Jews basically have to let loose their darkest impulses and their it's called redemption through sin. So you engage in sinful behavior to the extent that it becomes very obvious to everyone in the world. In order to draw the wrath of the world upon yourself, and then that triggers Armageddon.
Got it.
And then the Jews get their due punishment. And through that punishment, they attain redemption. And then Messiah comes.
Right. Because air quotes, he has to save them. Right.
And so when I first heard this, I thought, that can be serious, but it is serious. And apparently, people who are very powerful in Israel, you know, not marginal rabbis, but very, very prominent rabbis in Israel who are close to this Chabad movement, they firmly and passionately believe in that. And they are apparently the driving force, the spiritual driving force between Israeli government today and behind the Israeli government today and behind Benjamin Netanyahu.
He's an evil man.
They expected that Benjamin Netanyahu would be the last leader of the state of Israel before the Messiah comes. And so they have also apparently designated Trump as the forerunner of the Messiah. You know, like he would be the one who would create conditions for the messianic times and the Armageddon in order for the real Jewish Messiah. They actually regard him as a non-Jewish Messiah, because, you know, to fix up some really bizarre incoherence in this whole story, they had to invent that there will be two messiahs, actually. One that will be like the forerunner, the one that prepares, and he can be a non-Jew, he can be Messiah Ben Joseph. That's what they regard Trump as. And then the real one would be the Messiah Ben David. And so I thought, so is this
a religious war,
barbaric, savage behavior, been redemption through sin? Is this what it is? Because if so, it's been very successful.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, then you have a whole other side of the Jewish community who believe, and this is based on the Torah. They're reading of the, their covenant with God is that they have to wait for the Messiah. Mm-hmm. They have to be good and wait for the Messiah, and everything is in God's hands. And so for them, for people to create the state, you know, for Jewish people to create the state of Israel, to engage in sinful behavior, to bring about Armageddon, to gain their redemption in this way, and to drive this whole process, is to break up the covenant with God, which is a catastrophe. So they are extremely passionately opposed to the Zionist project and the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But they are completely disenfranchised. You know, you don't hear their voices. If it wasn't for social media, I wouldn't even know that these people existed.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very numerous. They're just voiceless and invisible to these other people. They are, out in the fore.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another aspect of it, which, you know, when you the more you read into it, the less you can dismiss it.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about implications here, and short-term implications. I was reading and hearing that Russia is now supplying Iran with arms to drag this out, and I'll say this again, not as a point of ethics, but as far as a strategy is concerned, why wouldn't they? Because we've done the same with them with the Ukraine war, correct? And so now, yeah, I mean, it's, and then as well as China supporting Iran, and again, why wouldn't they? Just because of a strategy, just keep us busy and so preoccupied so they can go do their thing, whatever that is. And then I'm thinking of like the biggest losers, not only the common people, whether that's in Israel, the Jewish people, whether that's in the Middle East, the Muslim people, or whether that's the Christian people in Europe and in the US. Obviously, the implications there are very dire. But I would think that Europe is actually screwed, because they depend on, correct me if I'm wrong, they depend on mostly these natural resources and potentially China.
Well, yeah, but it goes beyond that. You know, Europe has basically destroyed its own energy security.
Right.
They have the Germans have shut down every last nuclear power plant that they have irreversibly. They can't bring them back online. They actually destroyed them. They demolished them. They cut off their supply pipelines from Russia for natural gas. As far as the EU is concerned, that's so important that Everybody can starve, everybody can freeze to death, but we're just not buying anything from Russia anymore. That's it. We're too good for, you know, the Russian undemocratic, tyrannical hydrocarbons. They have been systematically destroying domestic production of fertilizers.
Mm-hmm.
And they've also been systematically destroying farm production,
yep.
deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
And so we find ourselves in a world of trouble. I mean, I can tell you, Andy, that if you walk into a supermarket in Europe, the availability and variety of food that you can buy is already visibly shrunk. And I'm not talking since Trump attacked Iran. I'm talking over the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had a very wide variety of, in France, very wide variety of very good, high quality, fresh produce. It's down by more than half.
Wow.
More than half. And the prices are more than double.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so when you add this Hormuz disruption on top of that, we are in a world of trouble. I don't know what the consequences will be, but we might have very severe food shortages in the near future, because you know you've lost access to natural gas, you've lost access to energy, you've lost access to fertilizers, your crop yields might shrink, and you've already been destroying your agriculture to begin with. And at some point, there might not be enough food to go around. And then what?
Yeah, and I was talking to you just yesterday, a really good friend of mine who manages money, and he's a boutique. He manages a lot of money, but he's a boutique firm. And he also is a trader and blah, 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 blah. And he loves, and we do, again, talking this agnostically, okay, divorce all the ethics and everything. And I shouldn't say loves, but he's like, the play is in agriculture right here. And I would agree with him, because they don't have, when I say they, the farmers, whether that's in Europe or the rest of the world, fertilizer either is will be non-existent, or it's going to be significantly reduced. And what is a farmer to do? They're still going to plant their crops, but you're not going to have the abundance of crops like you did before.
Yeah, and we've even neglected the agricultural practices that work without artificial fertilizers, because
right.
My understanding, and I've looked into this a little bit, because at some point in my life I did make an investment into some agricultural land, and I was going to develop. So I was studying if we should try to avoid artificial fertilizers and all this.
Me too. I was going to be a farmer. That was another.
Yeah,
that
I was
another
going to
life.
Try to. I was trying to avoid being a farmer, but you know, the farming, you know, of itself seemed to make sense. But you know, you can't do it without animals.
Yep.
You know, so you need animals. So you basically, to bring back abundant food production, you would have to go back to basically diversified family farms, where
maybe
you
that's
have
where we're going to get to.
Pigs and cows and chickens, and then
which are great fertilizer, right? They're excrete.
Yeah, exactly. They're excellent at doing that, and then you can. But it's limited in the sense that you can't have 1,000-acre cornfield.
Yeah, the scale's limited.
You know, you can have, let's say, a farmstead, and it can make so much potatoes and broccoli and eggs and meat and milk and cheese and stuff like that. But you can't have these rivers of soy and corn syrup and that. Well, you know,
we're bankers, actually, because you can't.
We're either going to have to get off of the war fix, or we're going to have to go back to, you know, some kind of pastoral living, which sounds good right now, except that I don't know if everybody gets to eat.
Right. Yeah. Talk, and I know this is really difficult because we don't really know exactly what this looks like, but talk more I guess gaming this out over the next several months, let's assume the war ends in a week. Let's assume you're still going to have high oil prices, right? I mean, you still have a fertilizer problem. And then you're probably going to have to put American troops on the ground to, I'm assuming that just for security's sake and all of that.
American troops on the ground where?
In Iran, right? I mean, for security's sake, or in the Straits of Hormuz, are already there. Do you think that's going to happen or inevitable?
I don't know why that is necessary. That's another one of those things that everybody knows and nobody questions, but I would ask why, because I guarantee you,
I'm not for that either, by the way, but go ahead.
you don't need to control oil-rich regions in order to have access to oil, because guess what? You can just buy it from producing countries. Austria, Greece, Switzerland, Ireland. In all of these countries, you can go to a gas pump and load up, fill up your gas tank and pay for it. And there's oil. And none of these countries have military bases or troops on the ground in the Arab Gulf or in Iran or in Saudi Arabia or anywhere like that, because they just buy oil from those people who sell oil. Now, it's very easy. The only reason why you need troops on the ground is to make sure that your corporations get the contracts. That's why. And the only reason why you need your corporations to get those contracts is because that's the only way that the bankers can be sure that that collateral is their collateral. As far as the corporations are concerned, they can do very nice, lucrative business by just buying oil from the Iranians or from the Russians. They don't need to go and develop the resources. They can just buy the products of Iranian or Saudi or Russian companies who do develop. Put on their margin and then sell it on their domestic market. They can make great business the way they have, like they don't have this all or nothing incentive that they have to be in the country. And in fact, we saw in Venezuela, they don't particularly want to be in the country either, because it creates all kinds of problems.
A lot of risk and then just poor will.
All of the, Trump brought all these oil corporations to say, like, hey, I just opened Venezuela for you. And only Chevron was interested in taking him up, because they were already in Venezuela and had a good relationship with Venezuelan government. So they don't perceive security to be a problem. But all the other ones said, this is a, it's too much. It's too risky. We're not interesting. We can do business on a different basis. So, but for the bankers, it's all or nothing, because if Iranian banks finance Iranian development of Iranian oil resources, then that's zero for JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs and Citi, right? But if it's Chevron or ExxonMobil, then that makes all the difference. That's why you need troops on the ground. So, they're going to want to have troops on the ground there, but do American boys and girls want to be on the ground in Iran defending JP Morgan's business? I don't know. And then will Iranians want them there? That I can predict. That's a no. Can Iranians do something about it? Yes, they can, and they're doing it. And Trump administration is not being forthright with the American people about the casualties, because I have some contacts who told me that the Americans are taking a pounding in Iraq, and that they're losing troops at least in the hundreds. And this was about a week ago, at least in the hundreds. And how do you get out of this? Again, it's one of those things that really it's real easy to start,
Hard to
but
get out of.
extremely hard to get out of. So in the near term, I think it's just going to escalate. I think it's going to fester. And I think that little by little, Iran is going to be winning the war. And I think that Iran has every incentive to completely evict Western interests from the region. And I wouldn't even exclude that part of their plan is to end the state of Israel, at least the way it's constituted today. And, we should remember the Iranians now control a lot of the proxy armies in Iraq. We have to remember that when Bashar al-Assad fell in December of 2024, right? Or three.
Yeah, I think it's four.
24. That the Syrian Arab Army didn't fall apart completely. That whole tank divisions crossed the border into Iraq. They're somewhere. Those tanks are somewhere still. And that part of the Syrian Arab Army went into Lebanon, and that Hezbollah is still active, and that Hamas is still there, and that the Yemenis are still there, and that more than, I forget what number, but 60% of the Jordanian population, don't quote me on that number, but it's a majority of Jordanian population are Palestinians. And the king is a weak, unpopular puppet who is only propped up by his Western masters. So he might fall, in which case Jordan could become a player on the board. It's getting Trump opened a can of worm that he cannot even remotely hope to control. And I think that the sooner he cuts his losses, the better. But I'm afraid that that's not going to happen. I think that that he's going to be doubling down and then doubling down again and then doubling down again, because like at this point, it's the gambler's ruin,
Two questions, and we'll end on this is. Well, maybe they're not questions, but I want you to talk about them. I was surprised that Saudi was supportive or seems to be supportive. And maybe that's not because of all of their oil interests. And they've always been, correct me if I'm wrong, antagonistic, or antagonistic is the wrong word, but have not been friendly to Iran. That's the first thing I want to ask you. And then the second thing, let's just imagine for a moment that this is over, that Trump does pull out, or we do pull out. What exactly does that look like, and what would happen?
I think that there's going to be political changes in the Gulf monarchies. I wouldn't dare predict what they might be, but Western powers, United States, obviously cannot protect these rulers anymore. So they're going to have to make nice with their people, or they're going to be swept from power. I think they're all going to have to rethink the petrodollar arrangement because, not only. Well, we've seen that Iranians have, and I thought this was very clever, have said you can sail your tankers out of the gate, out of the Strait of Hormuz, provided that you paid for it in yuan, not in US dollars. So I think that this, they will probably insist on this because this is a very important way to bleed the whole war machinery that's been turned against them. And then it suits multipolar integration. It suits the Chinese. It suits the Russians. It suits the BRICS movement. It suits the Belt and Road Initiative, and everything. So I think that there's like a whole tsunami gathering. As far as Saudis are concerned, they have American military bases on their territory. They have hundreds of billions of dollars in U.S. banks and American investments. And so they fear, because when the West sanctioned Russia, which is a much more powerful player than Saudi Arabia, they froze all their assets in Western financial institutions. They cut them off. So they could cut off the Saudis just as well. So they cannot just say, hey, guess what? We don't agree with this, so we're just going to take the side of Iran. But I think that inevitably they will have to radically change their foreign policies because the old arrangement no longer works, and they will have to, you know, forge a new future, let's say, without the Western colonial powers dictating their policy, their economic development, and all of these things.
Yeah. Alex, I've kept you long enough. We'll end on that. First of all, I want to just thank you. You're one of the most gracious guests I have, and I just really enjoy spending time with you. The second is people, they want to read, they want more of you. How do they get that? What's your Substack and what's your YouTube? And congratulations on your YouTube channel.
Oh yeah, thank you. Well, that's a lot of work.
It is. Tell me about it. Tell me about it.
Yeah. So, yes, thank you. I'm active on X. My handle is at Naked Hedgy, but I basically just shoot my mouth off there. I also have a daily Substack newsletter, which I think, given these circumstances, should be interesting for people who manage their own portfolios and trade. It's a daily trend following newsletter that provides trading signals for a set of key global 19 or 20 key global markets, you know, things like Nasdaq, S&P 500, treasuries, Nikkei, gold, Bitcoin, stuff like that. And then I also have it's called iSystem Trend Compass. And then I also have my own personal Substack where I write things of more personal interest, which is called Alex Craner's Substack. It's mostly, you know, geopolitics, history, some psychology, and stuff that I find relevant and interesting to write about.
Excellent. Well, I will put all of that in your YouTube channel. What's that address?
I think my YouTube channel is simply called Alex Craner. And then don't go to Alex Craner Official. That one is a fake. An AI scam. That's not me.
Okay. Well, I'll put all of this in the show notes, both on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify. Alex, it's always such a pleasure to have you on. You've become a really good friend of mine. I just really, as always, just really enjoy our time together. So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Andy. Honor is mine. Thank you for having me. And until the next time, take care.
Take care.